You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life.
Hello, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Fire and Chill. Today, we're going to be discussing the juicy topic of insurance. So I've actually had this requested a couple of times, so we thought we'd finally get stuck into it. And it's quite a meaty topic, so there's a fair bit to get into today. And Pat, you probably would have noticed this as well. It's insurance is one of those topics where it kind of divides people, and there can be some extreme views on either end. Like, there's a bit of a spectrum where people fit on their views on insurance.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good segue. This is just Dave and I's opinion on insurance. Don't write to us with angry comments. We understand people have different opinions, and that's all this is, two guys with a couple of opinions. So we hope you enjoy it.
And just before we begin, this is actually our last episode for 2021. So we just want to thank you quickly for your support this year, and we appreciate you tuning into the episodes. We really hope that you've gotten something out of the content that we've made this year, and we're looking forward to what we can produce next year, so stay tuned for that. And if you've got some stuff that you'd like us to discuss, like some episode topics that you would want us to get into, you can let us know. You can either send us a message like on our socials or through our websites, or also email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com, and we'll take a look at those and we'll put them in the episode list for 2022.
Woo!
So, as I was saying, Pat, there's a spectrum of where people sit with their views on insurance. And a lot of the times it's based on like all sorts of things, you know, their experience, how they feel about risk, how much kind of wealth and savings they have, what kind of stuff they have going on in their personal lives. So there's so many variables that can affect whether someone either likes or hates or is indifferent about insurance.
Yes, agreed. Some people literally just want to insure everything. Like, they're going to create a little cocoon of insurances around them so that will protect them from every possible eventuation. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's, you know, some people that have no insurances. They just don't want to pay the premiums, I suppose. Don't see the point.
All right. And I suppose, like, just to kick things off, we should discuss, I suppose, how insurance works, really. So, I mean, most people know this either intuitively or they've heard it before, but it's statistically true that insurance is a losing bet that we're making. So I think you would have heard that before, Pat?
Yeah. I mean, that's just, like you said, it's intuitive. It has to be a losing bet. Like, the company has to make money out of the business that they're providing, the service that they're providing. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. Yeah, it's not magic money. Like, it has to come from your premiums and everyone else's premiums. So
these premiums are, like, they're calculated by extremely smart people and probably even algorithms these days, like computer generated from human inputs, I'm sure. But those premiums are calculated with enough margin in them and at a price level where they can pay for all of their expected claims based on what they think people are going to put in as claims in the future, pay for all of their staff and all their operating costs, like their office rent and all the rest of it, and still come out with a profit for shareholders at the end of the day after all of those costs. And so this is not to say that insurance is bad as such, because insurance is a valuable service that society needs. So I'm not I'm not suggesting for a minute that insurance is a nasty business or an evil business or anything like that. But it is worth remembering this simple fact when we do think about insurance.
Yeah, we are all likely to come out behind by buying insurance, and a few of us, unlucky few, will come out ahead by buying insurance.
Mm. It's funny you say that because you frame it as unlucky. So yeah. you could see it in two different ways, couldn't you? You come out ahead by buying insurance, but that also means at the same time that you've had more expensive claims, which means, I suppose,
well, something bad has happened to you.
Yeah, quote unquote, yeah. Bad things happening to you, higher than average. So your bad luck, I suppose, can be profitable in that sense.
Oh, man.
And I'm sure we've all heard about insurance companies that are, you know, you would have heard these stories about the insurance firms and people trying to make claims for months on end, and trying to chase them up, and insurance companies trying to essentially dodge paying those claims and finding fine print where, okay, oh, sorry, you're not covered because of clause yeah. A23 subsection X of this of this policy document.
Yeah, yeah, and like kind of colorful interpretation of the policy document. It's like, no. Your house wasn't damaged by flood. It was damaged by rainwater. So you by a rain event. So you can't have any insurance money. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's a sad kind of reality that we've all kind of heard about plenty of times. So in one sense, like we do need insurance to some degree, but often many of us don't trust it at the same time, or we're happy to have it, but then at the same time you're paying for it, you're not 100% sure that they're going to come through when it comes time to claim. So there's a little bit of nervousness behind the scenes, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, yeah. Buying insurance is just like buying a seat at the courtroom table. It's like you've got it there, and so you have the ability to go to court to get your claim money.
Hey, is there an insurance that you can take out that protects you against an insurance company not paying you?
That would be something. That would be good.
That's a product idea right there.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's just like when, if you ever get, interesting story, bit of a digression. But, you know, sometimes when you go on holidays, you can rent cars.
Yep.
And then they always try and upsell you their insurance, which is like extortionate. It's like, yeah, an extra $30 or $40 a day. It's on like top.
Just as much as the car.
Yeah. Well, most travel insurance policies will cover you for a certain amount of rental car excess.
Okay.
So it's always cheaper to just go and get travel insurance that also covers you for rental car excess.
That's interesting. Okay, that's interesting. See, if I've rented a car, I've always just like asked them what the excess is. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm happy to pay the excess if that happens. Because like you said, usually like the insurance is just a big fat amount on top of your car hire purchase.
It's huge. It's like, yeah, $30 a day. Mm. So it's like, if you do the math on that, it's like $10,000 a year for, you know what I mean? Like, it's just clearly out of this world, that insurance.
Mm. And I suppose it is popular. I would bet that most people would opt for that because they don't want to come up with the excess if something happens.
The excess is usually in the vicinity of like $5,000, and you can pay more to reduce it to like a few hundred. So I am going to Adelaide tomorrow for a little getaway, and I've got a rental car, but instead of paying that excessive additional amount, I've got a general travel insurance policy that covers up to $5,000 of rental car excess.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And how much is the travel insurance?
The travel insurance was $60.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah. And that covers the rental car plus a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. Actually, you know, I did the notes for today's podcast, but travel insurance actually wasn't one of the things I wrote down. Maybe I should have.
Oh, well. We've digressed into it.
But the thing is, there's so many insurances that we can't possibly cover them all in one episode.
No. I suppose people will get a kind of idea of where we're coming from anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So let's just kick it off with the first type of insurance that we want to talk about. And that is the big one. And that is home or property insurance. So first, we'll go through these different areas of insurance and we'll say whether we have it or not. And then we'll give a few thoughts on each area. So do you have any home or property insurance, Pat? What do you reckon about it?
Yes, I have home insurance.
Or investment property insurance, rather, isn't it?
Well, it is at the moment, but that'll be promptly switched to home insurance.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've got a couple of building insurance policies as well, obviously, having a few investment properties. So this is definitely a policy that is worth having, I think, for pretty much everyone. And it's because it's one of those ones where it doesn't cost that much, but it protects you from a massive possible outlay or a massive possible cost in the future.
Yeah, yeah. So like you were saying, like, one event could be like your house burning down, and that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars for you to repair. So that is a, you know, life-changing amount of money for pretty well the vast majority of people. And insurance then kind of makes sense.
Yeah. And because the policies are generally like a few hundred dollars, they're not like massive amounts. So it seems like pretty good value. Because not many people got that much cash lying around in case the old house burns down.
No, you definitely can't self-insure that one. But how about contents insurance, Dave? Do you have any contents insurance?
Well, just before we get to contents insurance, I had this little comment I wanted to make. Is it actually crazy, though, to not insure your house if you are quite a wealthy person? Okay, how about a scenario? What if you have like $5 million worth of investments, you only spend maybe 50 grand a year. So you have more than enough wealth to sustain you. And so let's say your house burned down and it was going to cost you $400,000 to rebuild that house. Would it be crazy for this person not to have insurance on their home?
I mean, it wouldn't be crazy. It's definitely a defendable position at that point. Like, yeah, it would suck, but it wouldn't be life-changing.
Nah, because this person would just sell some shares or whatever from their portfolio, and they still have $4.5 million, which is way, way, way more than they need.
Yep.
And it wouldn't impact them whatsoever. I mean, it's a number on a spreadsheet maybe, but it's not.
Yeah. It's like you and I not having insurance on our mobile phone, because like it's just such a tiny amount. If something did happen to it, we'd just bloody replace it.
Yeah. So there's that way to look at it as well, which I don't think too many people consider. They just think, okay, it's always good to have it because it's expensive to have to pay the bill if something like that happens. But then you could also look at it in a different way, that if you are that wealthy, then that the home insurance policy is such a tiny expense that it doesn't even matter. So you can look at it that way as well.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. I'd be inclined to, when I do have that much wealth, or if I did have that much wealth, to just take the statistically winning bet instead of doing the risk-averse route.
That's interesting. At the moment, I feel like I would choose that option as well. So we're pretty much saying that we would go ahead and have no home insurance if we had substantially more wealth than we needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Ooh, that might... Ooh. A few people might not like that position, mate. All right, let's move on to contents insurance. Do you have contents insurance, Pat? You can No. You're renting right now, but you can get contents insurance, can't you, for renters? Everyone can get it.
Yeah, yeah, I could get contents insurance, but I'd never consider getting it.
Never have?
Never have.
Never will?
Never will. Well, for one, like at the moment, the entire contents of my apartment just isn't worth that much money, eh? Like we got a bit of furniture, some laptops. Like, what are we talking here, really? A few $1,000s?
Yeah, maybe $10,000 maybe. Because you'd have 10,000? To replace it with brand new stuff, I suppose. Well, you wouldn't have to, but
yeah.
$10,000?
Let's say 10,000, yeah. Let's say you have like a few diamond rings in there, you know, that you for some reason didn't have on your fingers when the house burnt down.
Yep, yep.
Again, it's not like a life-changing amount of money for me at this point if something did happen, like go and destroy my contents.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think this one is actually a popular type of insurance to have, even though I think this is one of the least beneficial insurances to have. I don't rate contents insurance whatsoever. I think I think for some reason there's an emotional attachment to contents insurance because it's like our stuff. You know, we don't want to lose our stuff. And if we lose our stuff, we want to have some cash. We want to be given money to be able to replace it. But the thing is, I had this conversation with my partner many, many, many years ago when we first met. She had contents insurance. And I was like, okay, well, you know, if something happened, we would have to replace this, this, and this. And she's like, yeah, yeah. But then I've got my other stuff too. Like she had some jewelry that was given to her by like family members or whatever. I'm like, but you can't get that back anyway. Because, like, it was sentimental items.
Yeah.
So when we talked it through, she's like, oh, yeah, actually, you're right. I can't, like, even if I'm insured for that stuff, I can never get it back. So yeah. Even if I have some money instead, that's nowhere near the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like a level of protection. But then when you think it through, it's like, oh, I can actually not replace those items, even if I want to.
Yeah. Even if you had the money, that stuff's never coming back. Like any of the stuff that you would have a sentimental attachment to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gone forever if it gets stolen or is burnt away.
So like this one, contents insurance, like you said, Pat, maybe $10,000. Is a starting point of where it might cost to replace a decent amount of our stuff. But then if you're in this position, like you're on the fire journey, I assume you would have like an emergency fund set up already, which is probably $10,000 or maybe more at this point. And you've probably got some investments too. So you could quite comfortably replace a fair bit of your stuff immediately, if not over the course of a couple of months at least, quite easily with just your emergency fund or just by tapping into a little bit of your investments. But another reason why I'm not the biggest fan of contents insurance, do you know what it includes, like the entirety of it?
No.
So I've seen a list of it, right, of what's included in the insurance, and there is stuff on there like I wouldn't believe it unless I saw it with my own eyes. Inside the policy, I don't know if this is true of every policy though, so it might just be the one that I saw in particular. In the policy, you were covered for cotton buds. No, not joking. Deodorant and like tiny, tiny, tiny things like that. There was like a list of them and I was just like, my mind was blown because I was thinking, who the hell would insure this stuff? Like, this is ridiculous. This is like...
inconsequential.
Yeah,
just crap.
But all this is, you can't opt out of it, I don't think, but all this is just like tiny, tiny, tiny little incremental ways to get those premiums up like a few cents, a few dollars, whatever, per year. And if you multiply that over each customer, so thousands and thousands of customers across the country over every year, then obviously it makes a lot of sense for the insurance company. It adds up to a big number. And that's exactly why they put these here in the first place. They're obviously worth putting in the policy for a reason because it adds up for them.
Yeah. Do you know how much contents insurance costs, by the way?
No, I don't.
No, I have no idea either.
I don't even care how much it costs.
No, fair enough. But I was going to say, like, I suppose this is true of every insurance, but I just feel like depending on the type of insurance, the math just doesn't make sense whatsoever. Like, there are some insurances where, like you were saying, like, oh, yeah, you can see the points, like this huge loss versus this tiny premium. But there are other insurances where it's just like, well, what the f***? Like, if I just don't pay this insurance, I'll have the money to buy a new car in 2 years anyway. Like,
and you don't have to have like a huge income and a huge amount of savings to cover these kind of problems like contents insurance.
No, so not at all.
Unless you have a house full of like really expensive furniture and, I don't know, a massive group of computers or something like...
art collection.
Yeah. So, I mean, in some cases, depending on what's in your house, I mean, maybe it is worth it if you have a monstrous amount of value tied up in personal possessions that are in your house. But for most people, I think it's hard to justify contents insurance once you do have a decent level of savings in your life. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I do think that's fair.
All right. Let's move on to car insurance, mate. Do you have car insurance or have you had car insurance?
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, I just got car insurance.
Oh, did you?
Oh.
Walk us through that.
Oh, like I have, in the changing of my role, I've requested a change in remuneration package, which means instead of being given a car, they're going to give me a car allowance. So I've gone out and bought a car.
What did you get?
Oh, a 2012 Mazda CX-5.
Okay.
Yeah. Beautiful car.
Happy with that?
Yeah. I think used car prices at the moment are crazy, but I just had to bite the bullet and pay it. So I did. Yeah, it's a nice car. Even 10 years old, like it's beautiful inside.
Still nice. Yeah. Anything under 10 years is still basically new, I think.
Well, it feels that way. I don't know. Maybe my mind is just stuck in 2010. But I feel like the difference between a car in the nine built in the 90s and one built in the noughties is like this huge chasm. Like it's huge.
That's actually a good point because that's when like all the new tech started coming into cars. So
yeah,
maybe we're different in the sense that we can remember and like had plenty of time and experience with the cars with none of that stuff.
Oh, like I still remember like the very first car I drove didn't have power steering. Like have you driven a car without power steering?
I have. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A little bit rough.
It is so rough.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that contrast between like us who are a little bit older. I mean, we're still pretty young, but a little bit older than some of the youngsters in the fire crowd who've probably only known like the newer tech style cars. That's interesting.
Yeah. But then like between the noughties and the 2010s, let's say, the difference is less than what it was between the 90s and the noughties. And I'll say it'll keep happening. The difference between the 2010s and the 2020s is going to be less again until we sort of get over that self-driving electrification hump.
That'll be the big leap up, I think, in difference. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So walk us through your insurance, mate.
Yes. This might surprise you. I got comprehensive insurance for the car.
Okay.
So we got third party, I think, is a no-brainer for most people. Like, yeah, having a car accident where a Maserati is involved is a life-changing event.
Everyone loves it. Whenever you mention it, someone has to say something about a Ferrari accident or hitting a Maserati. There's like almost no other option. That has to be brought up in the conversation.
But also, I feel like there was a bit of an information arbitrage that I took advantage of a little.
Oh.
Just a little.
Okay. What's that?
Well, my partner actually hasn't been driving. Like, she's had a full license for a long time, but she actually just hasn't been driving for years. So she's essentially like a new driver, yet she wasn't priced at the same risk as a new driver by the insurance companies because she's had a license for 10 years or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in that respect, the premiums were relatively like non-offensive, but I'm insuring someone who's much less experienced than the insurance companies realize because they just don't ask that question. They just assume if you have your license, you're using it all the time.
So you're quite happy being on record that you're saying your partner's a risky driver.
I'm just saying that the insurance companies probably assumed that she had 10 years of experience driving, whereas that's probably not the case.
Do they not price it more just around age rather than how, or do they actually ask how long you've had your license for?
They do. They ask how long you've had your license. Is it an open license? Your age, your gender, because young males are riskier drivers.
We're hopeless, mate.
We're so hopeless. We don't get that good head on our shoulders until we're at least 25.
Yeah. Even then, it's questionable, probably.
But another reason, say you are like the safest driver ever and you don't drive very often and you think that you just do not need car insurance. Something to keep in mind is even if you're not at fault, having insurance is very beneficial because then it's just like your insurance company fighting with another insurance company. Whereas if you're uninsured, it's basically, you know, David and Goliath, like the insurance company's going to try and bully you around and you're going to have to put up with that.
They'll send the collectors to the door.
They'll send the collectors. It'll end up in your credit report. Like you'll have to like be emailing them and telling them to go away and all that sort of business. Whereas if you're not at fault and your insurance company just takes up that fight for you, then you can just essentially be like check in with them occasionally and, oh, yeah, is it still going? Yeah, okay, just let me know what the outcome is.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. So a third party is usually a good idea, right? So
yeah.
But the fully comprehensive insurance is a little bit more maybe questionable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously the one that covers you for your car being damaged and being possibly even a write-off. So I think that side of things comes down to the cost of your car. How much would it cost you to replace your car? So if that's going to be 10 grand, would that hurt you financially, or would it be just fine? Like, just similar to the contents insurance, I guess. But then maybe if you're driving a $90,000 Range Rover, that's probably going to hurt. That's going to hurt a lot if you're in an accident where your car is really, really badly damaged. So it's very, very dependent on the value of your vehicle that you're driving.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think if the value of my car gets to about 10K, you're right. It'd just be like, why do I even have this comprehensive anymore? Like, what am I covering really?
Yeah. So I have just third party on ours. And even I've only had that for probably a year and a half. And before that, I didn't have any at all.
Oh.
No. I just, look, when I was really young, it was extremely expensive, kind of like you mentioned before, Pat. And so I was just thinking, no, there's no way I'm paying, I don't know if it was $2,000 or $2,500, or it was something monstrous when I first had my car and tried to get insurance. I just thought, no way, not worth it. So I just thought, if something happens, I'll pay for it. And something did actually happen. So I backed into a car and damaged, it wasn't an expensive car. I think it was a little Hyundai. And so I damaged the car, and then I also, that car itself backed into their garage. So I damaged the garage as well. And so I had to pay for both, obviously, by myself. But it was only about $3,000 or $3,500. So it wasn't even a catastrophic amount of money.
2 years worth of premiums.
Yeah, like exactly. I mean, it could have been a lot worse if I had have hit, you know, the fabled Maserati on the street there, but thankfully that didn't happen.
Have you seen just like the parting of the sea whenever there's like an expensive car on the road? No one wants to be near it. It's just like everyone avoids it.
Is that why that happens? I always wondered.
I know I do it. Like I see like a Tesla or something, I'm like, I'm keeping the hell away from that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. So that was... Yeah, that was a risk that I took on for a good 8 years, I guess, or actually more than that. And I probably have a higher risk tolerance than a lot of people, I guess. I didn't feel like I was taking such a big risk. And as our wealth got a bit bigger, I thought, look, if something happens, I'm happy to pay even tens of thousands of dollars. But then after we got this recent car, it's mostly my partner's car. She drives it way more than I do. So we had a talk about insurance and she said that she'd definitely be more comfortable with insurance. So I was like, okay, you know, let's have a look at it. And so we had a look and it was way cheaper than I could have ever imagined for third party insurance. So I was like, oh, this is fine. Let's just do this. This is fine.
What is it's like for a lady above the age of 25, what is it? It's like $300 a year or something?
$160, $162 or something insane.
What?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What?
It was bananas. It was under $200.
With who? Who are you with?
Budget Direct.
Oh, nice. Actually, I'm with Budget Direct too.
They're good, aren't they? Free plug. Free plug for Budget Direct.
We both independently ended up there after doing a few comparisons.
That's quite funny, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
All right, so we've covered car insurance. Let's move on to health insurance. Do we have health insurance, Pat?
Again, yes, but it's like the most basic of basic hospital cover.
Okay.
So I pay less for the hospital cover than I would pay in tax if I didn't have it.
See, that's the thing. That's the big, I suppose this is the big dividing point to bring up here with health insurance, because the cost actually can equate or can even become cheaper than the Medicare levy that you would otherwise pay if you didn't have it. Do you know what the specific numbers are for your situation, Pat, being a high income earner, like over 100K? I think that's roughly the threshold of where it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I don't remember where the threshold is. I think it might be 80 or 90K.
Yeah, I think it's like 90 plus.
Yeah, 90, and then you pay an extra 1% tax if you don't have health insurance. So that's an extra $900 a year. So if you can find a basic hospital cover for less than $900 a year, you're laughing. And then obviously as your income goes up, say you're earning $150K a year, 1% $1,500 becomes easier and easier to justify just getting a private hospital cover.
Yeah, gotcha. So is that essentially what you've chosen to do? Is that why? Or were there other reasons that went into that decision?
No, that's why. That is 100% why.
Is that on the advice of your Cayman Islands specialists, mate?
The Cayman Islands tax specialists have advised me that I can pay less tax by spending more money.
Interesting. No, look, that makes sense. There's definitely a threshold there where it absolutely makes sense to have health insurance. But so why have you gone for basic hospital? Do you want to discuss that? Because a lot of people go for extras as well, or they'll go for like a high-end hospital cover. You want to walk us through that decision?
I suppose like you, I'm just got a higher risk tolerance. So I'm confident enough in the public system that if something goes really wrong, I'll be able to get it taken care of. Relatively young and healthy at the moment, so I'm not worried about that. People do complain about waiting times, and I suppose that can be a risk, but I suppose it's just a risk I'm willing to take at the moment.
But waiting, what do you mean waiting times for what?
Oh, like some people have surgeries that are classed as elective, but sometimes it's elective in air quotes, like they're less mobile or they're in some sort of pain while they're waiting and it affects their lives.
But you get to skip that list, right? Because of your insurance.
Oh, probably. I haven't looked that far into it.
Yeah, because that's how it works. That's often why people get the insurance, so they don't have to wait on the list.
Oh, I thought you needed like the gold comprehensive.
I don't believe so. I feel like as you climb up in tiers of health cover, the number of things that you can get rebates for expands. The number of things that you're covered for basically expands, and your level of cover is better. So like you get a private room, and then probably for the highest top tier, you probably got like some Grand Hyatt type experience or something like that. but generally the level of cover gets a little bit fancier as you get a bit higher, and a few more things are included, I think. Maybe like some after surgery care and things like that.
Mm, yep.
Yeah, so I've chosen to not go with health insurance. I'm happy to use the public system because, I mean, if something bad happens, like emergency style, you're going to go to the public hospital anyway.
Yep.
And if something else happens where it's elective, you can either wait on the public waiting list or you can pay for that by yourself and go privately. So we've chosen to just do that. We've chosen just to, okay, if something happens and it's elective or considered elective, we're just going to pay for it if that happens, and we think we'll come out ahead than if we have insurance, because we're not fat cat high earners, Pat, like you, on the high tax bracket, so we don't get the same kind of benefit there or the tax saving that you do.
Yeah, and you said something important there. Like if shit hits the fan, you are sent straight to the public system. The private system isn't equipped to deal with emergencies like that, or deal with like crazy like emergency surgery. It's always the public system, whether you have private health insurance or not.
So if something bad happens, you're going to be reliant on it anyway, even if you're paying for, nice health cover.
Yeah.
So how about extras insurance? What about that? Because that's something that usually goes hand in hand with health insurance, and people like to add it on the end. And, it can come with a certain amount for dental or for physio or chiro or whatever you want to choose. There's a lot of options available. And that's like, it's like when you add it on to your health insurance, it's not a lot more. Did you look at the cost difference between like hospital only and then hospital and extras before you decided? Or did you just say, okay, I'm just going to get hospital only and that's it?
I always thought it was like roughly the same again. Like it was roughly double when you get extras.
Wow. Okay. Maybe it's different from when I looked at it a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
I didn't think it was that much more. I thought the bulk of the cost came from the hospital insurance.
No.
Could be wrong.
Could be wrong. In any case, when I did look at it, and every time I have looked at it, I've just decided not to get it because I don't see the value there, basically.
Because you don't mind paying $80 if you have to go see the chiro or the physio or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Like when I need to see the dentist, I pay the dentist.
But Pat, you'll get... If you spend $80 at the physio, you might get $40 back or $50 back. Wouldn't that be good to get some money back?
That would be good, yeah. But yeah, you read through these policies and like there's all of these like maximum claim amounts and all of these excesses. And by the time you add in your premium plus the excesses you have to pay along the way, Are you really saving any money at all?
Sometimes there's, like you said, like a claim maximum. So they're designed so that you can't rort it, I suppose, and get way more value than you're paying the insurance company, which is fair enough, obviously. But it is definitely designed with caps or with limitations in place. So it's quite often it's hard to come out ahead.
Yeah, and co-pays and excesses. So just because you got insurance doesn't mean your costs stop at your premium. Like you're still,
yeah.
If I'm going to the dentist and I'm paying $400, then the person with extras insurance is going to the dentist and still paying like $150 or $200. So,
yeah, definitely. So I think the main benefit behind health insurance is that I suppose for your surgeries which are elective, you get your own room and you can choose your doctor and stuff like that. People like that, I suppose, sense of control and choice. So in a sense, that's part of what you're paying for as well. And then obviously the wait times, if you're just going public, that can be, I mean, you might have to wait, I don't know, 9 months or something for a knee replacement or as an example. So yeah, but like we said, if you have some savings or something like that, you can cover that cost yourself and go private anyway, which is what we're personally choosing to do.
Mm.
And we're already paying for the Medicare, like we're already paying for the healthcare system in our taxes anyway, Pat. So it's not like we're mooching off the government. It's designed like we're paying for it.
Yeah, an extortionate amount. No, not extortionate. It's pretty good value.
From what you read, it's supposedly one of the better ones across the globe.
Yeah, like we're not paying that much, honestly, for what we're getting.
Well, I'd much rather our health system than America's.
Yeah, for sure.
And I feel like that's part of the risk when you start having more and more people go to private healthcare, because then the control is a lot more controls in the private sector.
Yeah.
And I feel like one of the best things a country can do for its citizens is to have free public healthcare. So I want to support that by using it and by being one of those people that is relying on it and choosing to use only that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not going out of your way to use it.
I want to get my money's worth, Pat. I'll take on all these risky side projects so I could use it.
No, it is nice. Like it does seem pretty inhumane to not help people with health issues when we can.
So I feel like the more we use it, the better it is, because the more we use it, the more money that we'll get put back into it. But if less and less people use it, then less money will get put back into it. So I feel like it's kind of good to support it in one sense. Does that make sense? Not really.
The more people who use it, the more money that goes into it.
Because the more people that are reliant on it versus using private, then the more that will be reinvested into it, because it's such a great public need.
Yeah.
But if less and less people are reliant on it, the government's quite happy and willing to put less money into it unless they have to, you know?
And just cut it away.
Yeah. That's partly why they're trying to encourage like private healthcare with the tax rebates and things like that.
Yeah. Which probably a waste of time, honestly.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah, no worries. How about life insurance and total permanent disability? Dave, do you have any of this?
I don't. And I suppose we'll throw income protection in here as well. So they're not quite the same thing, but they do all protect against, I suppose, your ability not to work and not to earn an income for the household. They're all kind of related in that sense.
Yep.
So no, we don't have any of these insurances. And I never have, except for income protection, which was built into my old job. So it was part of our EBA agreement or something like that. So we actually had an income protection policy in there. If I didn't have that, I don't think I would have taken it out personally, just because of, well, for one thing, we were living on less than one of our wages. So if one of us wasn't there, the other one would have been fine. If one of us couldn't work,
yep,
then the other one would have been fine. So for us, it didn't really make sense. How about you?
I've never gone and sought out like life insurance or income protection insurance or any of that. Again, another digression, but have you ever sat and watched like midday TV and like the insurance?
I know where this is going. Every 10 minutes, they'll do a 10-minute story and then they'll break for 15 minutes for essentially an ad for income protection or funeral insurance or life insurance or all the rest of it?
Oh, it just feels so filthy, like pulling on the emotional heartstrings. Like,
exactly.
You know, you see like these two older people like going through. It's like, what would happen to your partner if you were no longer around? Who would pay for their funeral? It's like, what?
It's so like, in one sense, when I see it's marketing, it's all it is. When I see marketing like that, at first I laugh because, oh my God, this is hilarious. But then I'm a little bit sad, and then I'm a little bit annoyed because I know I'm sad because people are kind of falling for it, even if they don't really need it because of the way it's being
promoted
to them. And then I'm a little bit annoyed because I realize that it's just a big game of manipulation.
Yeah.
That's all it is. They're just trying to make us think we need something that we probably don't need by using all these emotional tactics to try and claw you in and to take out the policy, which is just... So I go through these three different emotions when I see marketing for certain types of insurance like that.
When I see like emotional marketing like that, it immediately puts me off altogether. Like I just can't be engaged by that sort of stuff.
Because you know you're being manipulated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like it has the opposite effect on someone like me.
Yeah, yeah, me too. That bullshit detector is just going, that red alarm is just going off.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what is this crap?
Oh.
And anyway, I was going to say, we probably all have at least some of this insurance already inside our superannuation accounts. So, yeah. Check what you're covered for inside insurance, and if it suits you, then it might be just good enough as it is.
Like, just because this insurance has never felt right for Pat and myself, that doesn't mean it's not right for you. Absolutely not. I mean, there's many, many cases where this can make a lot of sense. If you're the only earner in the household and your partner and you've got some kids and you've got kind of a large mortgage, and they would like struggle if you're not around, then like 100% this kind of insurance is probably a good idea.
Yeah, agreed.
But yeah, just check what's in your super because you've probably already got it. I actually think, Pat, that not many people realize what kind of insurance they've got inside their super, because it's one of those things that's when you sign up to super, it basically happens by default. You don't even know it's happening. And you're like, oh, I've got some insurance. Do you remember having a surprising moment looking at your super at a young age? Like, oh, insurance? What? I don't remember signing up for that.
I remember like looking at my growth and I'm like, what is all this? Like, why isn't it? And then looking through it.
The fees.
And then seeing the insurance coming out. Like, oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. I actually cancelled my insurance inside super because I didn't want to have it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I feel like at this point, we don't need life insurance.
Mm, you're right.
I don't see what, don't really need income protection either. So, no, I went ahead and cancelled that inside super.
Well, it makes sense. Like, if you like are earning no or very minimal income, exactly what is the income protection doing for you?
I'm not even sure it would. I'm not even sure it would work. Yeah, yeah. Because yeah. What are you claiming for?
You gotta claim.
But the life insurance and that, I think that's the main one that's inside there usually, life and TPD inside super. But yeah, we cancelled that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Have you still got yours?
Yeah, I do actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. So it's just plugging away there in the background.
Do you know if it's like a decent amount or you don't even look at it or?
You're right, I've never looked at it. I mean, I've seen the fees coming out.
Guys, listen to this, Pat. You're supposed to be an example for people of how to manage your finances and you don't even know what's going on inside the super.
The insurance is big. It's so like stereotypical though, isn't it? It's like you can have your money all sorted, but the insurance is like, what's going on there with insurance?
Is that also because you're not the biggest fan of super? So you're like, super, you don't want to dive into it?
Well, I'm, yeah.
Is that part of it? Because it's like,
I mean, I think part of it is like, I don't even consider it money that I care about it. I mean, I care about it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying like I'm discounting it altogether, but.
You don't want to transfer it to me or?
But it's not like the biggest deal to me, like super. It's like a backup fund. And so I suppose getting life or TPD out of what is a backup fund anyway makes kind of logical sense.
So I've just given you a weekend task to do.
Yeah. I'll have a look at it.
All right, next one. So how about pet insurance?
Ooh.
Do you have any pets, Pat? I don't even know.
No, I don't have any
you
pets.
Don't have any pets.
Yeah. How much does your pet cost you?
Too much.
Too much.
Too much, mate.
Your yes. fur baby.
So we don't have pet insurance, but we used to have pet insurance.
Right. Okay.
I don't even know if pet insurance was a thing more than 10 years ago.
Okay.
Do you reckon? It seems new.
I mean, I definitely see more like midday adverts about it.
How much midday TV are you watching, Pat? Supposed to be at work, mate. Just sitting in the lunchroom, smoking your cigars while all the workers are sweating their asses off out there.
Drinking the cognac too, mate. You forgot about on the mahogany table that was built for me.
With stacks of leather-bound books behind me.
No, I don't own a pet. How much does a pet cost, mate? Tell us all about it.
So pets are kind of cheap. Like we have a dog. He doesn't cost all that much, like in terms of food and basic upkeep, I suppose you call it. But the costly thing is when something happens, like they swallow part of the toy and it doesn't come up, so they need to get it taken out of their stomach or something, which has actually happened to our dog perhaps, I want to say, 3 times now.
Oh.
So, yeah. So, yeah, that's where it gets a bit expensive. And the pet insurance, actually, when we first took it out, it was quite good cover. Like, I had a look at it because I'm always open to these things. I'm not like I'm not saying never to any of this stuff, except maybe contents insurance. That one just annoys me. Yeah, so I had a look at it and the coverage was actually quite good. The price was quite low. This was probably 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago now. And so we're covered for like up to $20,000 of whatever claims per year. And the policy was maybe $50-$60 a month. And there was no excess or something at the time. And it was actually reasonably good value because our dog, being a British bulldog, was one of the what they class as like a high risk type dog, where they're more likely to have certain problems than other dogs are. So they kind of put you in this more expensive category, I think. It was actually decent value, but it was going up in price like 20% a year, 25% a year. So after 3 years, it basically doubled. And then after another 3 years, it basically doubled again almost. So we canceled it a few years back because it was basically going to cost almost $2,000 for the year for this insurance policy. And also the benefits got watered down over time. So the excess became quite a lot. They didn't cover. They used to give us 100% back at the start and then it changed to like 80% back. And it just became like a worse and worse deal over time. And then I just couldn't justify it in the end because each time he's had something wrong, I think the total cost was about like $2,500, $3,000. So if they want me to pay $2,000 for a insurance policy and I'm going to have to pay excess and only get 20% of the claim back, I mean, 80% of the claim back, then that means they're expecting something like one of these claims every 9 months or 6 months or something like that. So it just became way too high to justify. So we're quite happy to pay, and we did recently, if something goes wrong. But it can get expensive. So if you can't or don't want to come up with that kind of cash, like maybe multi-$1,000s of vet bill in one hit very quickly, then it's probably a good idea.
Mm.
Yeah, but I haven't looked at prices for quite a while because, we're in that. I don't even think we'd be able to get insurance at the moment because our dog's getting a bit older now. He's like 8.5. So usually the price gets higher and higher as your dog gets older. So it's something you want to do when the dog's a bit younger.
Mm, fair enough. So they don't even insure your dog when your dog's most likely to actually need insurance.
Well, it's a bit funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost like it's designed that way, Pat.
Well, I was going to say, like, they're always designed to come out ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
And like we said at the start of the episode.
Mm. All right, so we've covered quite a few insurances. Did you want to cover anything about travel insurance, Pat, since you probably got much more experience with it than I have and I forgot to put it in our doc?
Yeah, no worries. So I think travel insurance, particularly when traveling overseas, is just like a no-brainer. Like, you don't have the same level of public health care overseas that you do in Australia, and those costs can just be wild if something does happen to you while you're overseas. So I've never traveled without travel insurance. I've never actually needed to use it, which is great.
That's good. So yeah.
That's not a terrible thing. I have wasted money, quotes unquote, but
but not really in a sense.
Not really, no. And domestically, I've only ever gotten travel insurance domestically when I plan to rent a car, like I was saying earlier, because rental car excess is generally around $5,000, but if you get travel insurance, that'll cover the rental car damage excess if you do get in an accident. And it comes with like all of the other benefits that travel insurance would generally come with, like flight cancellations, lost baggage, all of that business. So it's just a no-brainer to get that instead of like the rental car excess reduction at the counter.
Mm. And it's relatively cheap by the sounds of it.
Yeah, yeah, it's super cheap, depending on where you're going and all that business. I think even when I traveled for like 3 months to Europe, it was a few hundred dollars. Like, it was not that much money.
Yeah, right. Do you think the costs would have gone up quite a bit now since COVID? Just because of maybe there's a higher risk of something happening?
Not sure.
Of you being, you know, holed up in a hospital?
I'm pretty sure most of the policies don't cover like pandemic-related stuff. Mm. So that's something to keep in mind.
Another product idea, COVID insurance.
COVID insurance, yeah. They wouldn't even know how.
All right, so we've covered quite a few types of insurance. Let's move on to a little bit of a different line of thinking. Is it possible, Pat, to create your own type of insurance, to create your own coverage in a sense? Because I reckon it is. I reckon it might be.
Yeah, of course. Like, if you've got enough money, you essentially self-insure. So having enough money to pay for your own problems has been given a special name called self-insurance.
Mm. And so in the smallest sense, that's things like that extra warranty when you buy a fridge, or like that thing for you, that insurance for your phone, or other types of like small problem insurance, we'll say. And I would even put, like, as soon as you build up an emergency fund or some savings or whatever, you can pretty much cover for things like contents insurance, I think, at that point, depending on your stuff, obviously. And then possibly even depending on your car, then car insurance, apart from third party. But yeah, you can see that as your savings build up, you can start to have your own little security blanket or your own little coverage for these things that might go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that also means that, I mean, as your savings build, you can basically start to whittle down the types of insurances that you have little bit by little bit.
Yeah.
Because, like, the problem, I think, is I had this conversation with someone the other day, like, who mentioned that there's so many different types of insurance these days. And the problem with that is because there's so many different types, right, we can spend a lot of money on insurance. And by spending a lot of money on insurance, there's often, it makes it harder to save. And when it's harder to save, it's harder to build up savings and provide like your own sort of coverage, your own emergency fund and your own savings. So then it makes you even more reliant on insurance now and in the future, which is kind of like this vicious circle happening.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And you can even take that to like where you are now, Dave, like you're financially independent. So you don't need life insurance. You don't need income protection insurance. And if you had, like we were discussing earlier in the episode, if you have like $5 million, do you need house insurance at that point? Mm. Probably not.
Mm. Yeah, and yeah.
It's probably interesting that you had that discussion around just how many insurances there are. Like, it's mind-boggling, the number of insurances. I suppose that kind of feeds into part of why I'm a bit more on the risk-averse end. Because being on the conservative end, like, I could easily spend $10,000 or $20,000 a year on insurances. And that's just like a non-starter for me. Like, it's just way too much. It's way too risk averse.
It's stomach churning.
Well, there's insurances for everything. Like you said, there's car insurance, there's pet insurance, there's house insurance, there's contents insurance, there's rental car insurance, there's travel insurance, there's extended warranties, there's phone insurances, there's... It's like funeral insurance. People get that too now. It's like, oh.
If they can think it up, you can insure it.
Basically, yeah. If you can aggregate all the risk together and sell it out at 10% profit, why not?
Yeah. And I think another thing is that not only when you start building up savings can you kind of break away little bit by little bit from different types of insurance, but you're also earning returns on your money. So you're actually, your little pool of insurance, I guess, that you're building up is actually getting bigger each year because of the compounding returns, which means that you actually have a greater number of dollars to call on in the future if you do need to claim against your insurance. So, and that's actually the opposite of your insurance, because when you have insurance, you are paying out increasing sums of money each year because your policies are going up in price. But when you're saving and doing your own type of insurance, you're actually better ahead each year for not having the insurance, but doubly so because your money is compounding each year too.
Yeah.
So they're both working in opposite directions.
Yeah. And you need to get to a point where you can like reach escape velocity, essentially. Like you get enough money that it starts working for you and you can start to build up more cash and start, like you said, dwindling down the insurances. And then the more insurances you get rid of, the more money you have to save and put into this pot and increase your savings further.
Interesting, right?
Yeah. Not to say that we'll get rid of all insurances always, but yeah, it's just an interesting thought to think about.
But I suppose the other thing to do, like the other thing with insurance is it's not only like a numbers game. So there's a lot of, I suppose, psychological reasons that people choose insurance, even though we know that the numbers don't work in our favor most of the time. So why do people get insurance, Pat? Like what's going on psychologically that draws us into wanting to have insurance?
It's just peace of mind. Relax about like really bad case scenarios. Basically, protecting yourself against the very worst case scenarios is generally where insurance is most valuable.
And then it's just one of those things where, okay, I just pay this insurance. I know it's not a great, I suppose, investment with my money. I might come out, I'll probably come out slightly behind over time, but at least I know it's covered. That's kind of the train of thought there, which makes sense. Like you can definitely see the appeal there.
Yeah.
I think there's also maybe some other things going on too, though. Do you think there's a little bit of a fetish over like the, we've talked about this before, but do you think there's also like the tax fetish thing going on here? You know, if I have health insurance, I pay less tax. If I have income protection, it's tax deductible. That kind of feels good.
I mean, it feels better than paying extra in tax, right? If I'm going to pay the money, I might as well get something out of it, right?
Yeah, but you might still be worse off though. That's the thing. It's not like...
Sometimes, yeah. You can still be worse off, yeah.
So I think that's part of it, but maybe I'm being cynical there. And there's also the other side of it, like we mentioned a little bit earlier, like the maybe like a fetish of free stuff, you know, with health insurance and extras, you often get quote unquote free dental checkups and stuff like that, which can feel good for people, you know? I get a free checkup each year or whatever included in my extras insurance.
Yeah, which is, you know, actually a great thing that the insurance companies do. Like, tell the people to go and get a free checkup, protect their investment, essentially their investment in you. Like, if you can look at it that way.
Okay. Because you're possibly preventing against larger future dental claims. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah, exactly. That's interesting. So you think it's like a self-protection that the insurance companies are...
Yeah, it's a calculated risk. It's like, well, if we can get 10,000 people to have a $100 checkup, it'll prevent 300 people from having like $10,000 worth of like... major dental surgery.
Huh. I never thought of it like that before. Do you reckon they've sat down and they did those numbers? Or do you think it's just I just thought it was a case of like, let's just build it into the price because people like free stuff. So let's just like, you get one free checkup and, or two free checkups, whatever it is. And people like it because they've liked the feeling of free stuff.
Well, that might be part of it, but I'm sure there's like actuarial stuff going on there.
Interesting. I also think there's something else going on at play too. I also think that one attraction of insurance is that we're protecting against bad things happening to us, more or less. That's basically what it boils down to. So I think that part of the attraction of insurance is that if we have a policy that protects against something, when that bad thing happens, we get compensated for it financially. And I think that plays a big role in when people decide whether to take out insurance or not. So say you have a car accident or something happens, you have a house fire, your house doesn't burn down, but your contents get kind of destroyed. So you're like, oh, this shit thing happened to me. Hey, but at least I get some money because I get kind of compensated from insurance. So I think, do you think people want to feel a little bit, they want to feel like they got something out of it, that it wasn't just a shit event, that when something happened to them, they want to get compensated in some way for a bad event?
Oh, maybe. I'm not sure. I've never thought of it like that, but
okay, man, maybe I'm just like the super cynical one with insurance. I don't know.
Maybe
I'm the grumpy one today.
Well, speaking about grumpy, we have a listener question about insurance.
Mm.
Do financial advisors get better access to insurance, Dave? I've heard this, but I don't know. Do you know any more about that?
So, yeah, look, we got this question and I found it quite interesting because I actually never heard this before. Had you heard of this idea or this statement before, Pat?
Like, it gets around on forums, but I've never found any official looking or sounding information about it.
Okay, interesting. I had never heard of it before in my life, but I went to old Dr. Google and I went Googling about it and I couldn't find anything. So, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't sound right. The idea that a select group of people get better access to insurance than the majority of the population. I'm skeptical of that. I don't feel like that's
possible, but why would an insurance company narrow their possible like target audience to sell the product to?
Yeah, I don't know about this one, man. I struggle to see it. I mean, it's definitely possible, like you said, and I could be wrong here, but this it does sound a little bit like a rumor that was started by a group of advisors.
But like, apparently, again, I just hear this from forums and Facebook posts and that sort of thing, so I can't verify any of it or any of what I'm about to say, because this information just isn't available from any reputable sounding source at all.
It's anecdotal.
It's all anecdotal. But I was reading a post the other day and they went to an advisor to get some of this insurance, some of this special insurance.
Give me the good stuff.
give me the special insurance, please. I heard you got the better stuff. And apparently, like, this person asked the advisor what their remuneration was from this product. And they said that it was 66% of the first year's premiums and then 20% of the premiums thereafter.
Far out.
66% and 20% ongoing for as long as you have the insurance.
Every year.
Yeah.
So am I just to take that as being some overpriced insurance? Because where's that money coming from? That money's coming from somewhere.
Well, exactly. Like we were saying before, they have to pay for all the offices, all the advertising, all the electricity, all the staff wages. And now, like, they also have to pay for these salesmen to the tune of 20% of your premium.
All of the claims, all of the costs, and then whatever's left over, they've got to give 20%. No, not whatever's left over. 20% of the initial amount, they've got to pay that to an advisor. And then they're supposed to make a profit after that.
Then the insurance companies have to make a profit after that.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you want to know, like, just if that's true, then that just illustrates, like, what has to be a bad long-term bet. Like, they can't be paying out any more than 80% of the premium in claims, but more likely even less than that because of all those other costs Dave and I just said. It'd have to be 60% or 50%.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I mean, I don't see what the reason would be that certain special advisors would have access to better types of insurance. I'm not sure how that would work, why it would be structured that way.
More importantly, I don't know how to verify if that's true or not. I mean, it might very well be true.
Yeah, of course.
But like, unless I go to an advisor and ask for some of this special stuff, I'm not sure how to verify it.
You should go incognito, Pat, with a hat and a trench coat and a mustache and go into advisor zone so they won't know who you are and ask for the special type of insurance. See what they say.
Maybe I will. Yeah, I don't
They'll
know.
They'll go, wait, I know this guy's voice.
I know this guy. He's trying to con me.
All right, so maybe we'll leave that knot untied because we're not 100% sure of the answer, but we're a little bit skeptical.
Yeah, definitely.
If anyone has more information on that, definitely let us know because we would love to be shown or proven otherwise so then we can share that with everyone.
Yep, that'd be good.
All right, so after all that, let's go through a couple of little points on how we can optimize our insurance and reduce our costs in this area for the stuff that we choose to insure.
Yep. So you need to think about how you would cope if, like, the bad event happened that you're supposedly insuring yourself against, whatever it may be, health, car crash, house burnt down. Like, how would you cope financially? And whether, like, you can deal with that appropriately or not.
Because, I mean, maybe you can, but maybe you can't. So that's exactly where this decision-making framework comes in to help you figure out whether insurance makes sense for each different area. But, I mean, even just thinking it through, whether you would be okay if that thing happened or not and whether you would be just fine, this might help you notice one or two insurance policies that you had in the past, but maybe you don't need them anymore.
Yep.
So definitely worth thinking about. And for the insurance that you do decide to keep, I think we'd both agree that you should probably just go for the highest excess you can possibly afford.
Yeah.
That will help you reduce those premiums, those payments each year. If you're willing to chip in some cash in the event that you have to make a claim.
Yeah. And you need to, like, do the math in your head. Like, when getting the car insurance, there was a range of excesses I could have chosen from, like, I think as low as $400 or something all the way up to $2,000. But the thing is, even if I went for the $400 excess and let's say I had a $1,000 accident, I probably still wouldn't claim on my insurance for a $1,000 accident, even if I had the $400 excess, because I don't want that on the insurance record. I don't want it affecting my claim, like my future premiums, et cetera, et cetera. It's probably, like, not worth the hassle at that point to go through an insurance.
Yeah, interesting point. Yeah.
So I never go for low excesses because even with that in place, I still wouldn't use it if I got into an accident that would call for it.
Yeah.
I'd only use insurance for, you know, something that would be like several thousands of dollars, for example.
Yeah. And so also when you're looking at those excesses and that, you also want to shop around at what different insurance companies are offering, because, I mean, those prices vary a lot from one insurer to another. So you definitely want to have a look around. And especially when you get your renewal in your email or whatever each year, because, I mean, it might be a good deal this year, but maybe next year is not such a good deal. There might be a new competitor who's going to offer you the same insurance for a lower price, or you might just get hit with the old lazy tax. You know, this is the regular customer. We're just going to reward them by shafting them with higher price.
Those companies know. They know how many customers they're going to lose by raising premiums a certain percentage, and that will still net them more money overall. They know it, and yeah.
There's just a reluctance to leave because it's hard work. You gotta switch to a new one, and there's a little bit of effort there, and they know that
it'll creep up over time for sure.
Yeah, so you definitely want to stay on top of it. And then also consider scaling down the number and also the types of insurances that you have as your wealth grows, if you feel comfortable with that, or increase your excess further as your savings build. And just hopefully it's clear that by us saying that, you know, as your savings grow and it helps you reduce your insurance, which also reduces your costs further, and you're likely to come out ahead rather than behind, that actually helps you save even more. So you can see how having savings helps you save more in the future, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And if you do want to retire early, then maybe consider having insurances inside super. So income and life and total permanent disability, that just leaves you more cash outside of super to invest. Now, obviously, you need to consider what sort of insurances you can get inside super and what you can get outside, and compare those appropriately, see what cover you're getting. But just something to keep in mind, that that's from one pool of money that you won't get access to 60. And the other pool of money is money you have available to you right now.
It's funny, when you were mentioning that, something popped into my mind. I would rather be ripped off with my insurance inside super than pay for insurance outside of super, just because I want to control those. I want to have access to those dollars to help me, you know, because you keep that money outside super as much as possible. You can pay off your mortgage, or you can build investments, and that's going to help you create freedom a lot sooner, depending on your age. But yeah, I just thought, yeah, I'd rather be ripped off than have it outside super. So the whole point of insurance is to, like, not to protect us from loss, because insurance itself kind of is a loss on average. The whole point of it is really to cover against massive financial problems, I think, that would really, really hurt us financially. Do you think you agree with that, Pat, as a summary?
For the most part, yeah. There's obviously a few caveats in there, like, oh, some people get private health insurance because they wouldn't be able to afford the surgery themselves, like if they were paying for it privately, but then they'd have to wait a long time on the public waiting list. But yeah, I'd say generally, for the most part, it's just to protect you against large financial issues.
Yeah, because it definitely does make sense in a lot of cases to have insurance for various things in our lives. So, and only you really know what you're comfortable with. Like we said, there is some psychological reasons and benefits to having insurance versus not having it. So it depends on so many things, like whether you're married or not. Do you have kids that you have to take care of? How much are your expenses? How much can you save each month? What's your current wealth like? I mean, there's a million factors.
Do you have one income or two incomes?
Yeah, a million different factors.
Many things influence sort of the value that you can get out of insurance and where you see the value. So yeah, as your wealth grows, the less types of insurance you'll probably need ongoing, which means you'll be even better off. I think Dave and I take a pretty minimalistic approach to insurance.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
So we both just take the attitude that we want to protect against stuff that would be really damaging to us financially and just be a horrible situation to be in, basically.
Well, yeah, no one wants to, you know, do what you and I have done and save our entire lives.
And then have it taken away.
Well, in a way, we might even be in a worse position than some people because if you're broke and you get hit with $500,000 bill, just go bankrupt.
Bankrupt.
And
we actually have to pay it.
Yeah. But like for us, we would actually have to pay the $500,000 bill. We don't have the option to just go bankrupt.
Well, maybe your special accountant, maybe he's got a lawyer friend that you can talk to. You can move some assets around, Pat. Cayman Island lawyer?
Well, apparently this is one of the great benefits of having a trust. It's asset protection.
Mm-mm. No, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we do take a pretty minimalist approach to insurance and only the big stuff mostly for us, and the rest of the stuff we choose to self-insure and invest those savings instead. And then we can still pay for that stuff if that happens in the future because who knows? I mean, at some point, some of those things are likely to go wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so we hope you've enjoyed today's discussion on insurance. Thanks again for listening to the podcast in 2021. Pat and I really appreciate it. We're actually going to take one fortnight off. As I said at the start, this is our last podcast for 2021. So I hope you have a great Christmas and holiday break, and we'll see you again next year in 2022.